session number 14974, Paul Armstrong, reel 14.
Armstrong, reel 14. You were on the coast quite a while, Mr. Armstrong. What kind of leisure and what opportunity for leisure did you get?
Very little indeed. In fact, I can say to you, I was hoping to be married during the summer. A girl who I'd known since she was five, and I'd applied for leave to be married, and each time, three times, it was granted and then withdrawn the day before because of the urgency of our training. The fourth time, having had an ultimatum from my fiancé to say that if it was off again, the wedding was off altogether. And I spoke to Robert Allen, who was the second in command of our company, acting while Major Hanmer was away on leave, told him the situation, and he said, go the night before. I went the night before, and happily was able to be married. I had 3 days leave, and came back on the third day to find that my leave had been cancelled. But Robert Allen said to the colonel, oh, I'm sorry, sir, I haven't got a forwarding address. I have no idea where he is.
When you applied to be married, in effect, did the army or the colonel or whoever it was, did they want to know who you were marrying and details and this kind
no,
of thing?
No, not in wartime. This was different in peacetime. In peacetime, subalterns didn't expect to be married, but in wartime, it was our business. And you can imagine that it wasn't very pleasant being apart within a matter of days of being married, but I made acquaintance with an hotel owner, and he asked me to he had two daughters living at home, same age as my wife, and he asked me if my wife would like to come and stay there. So, naturally, we said yes. My wife came down, and because of the regulation that visitors weren't allowed in the coast at that time, he overcame that problem by engaging her as a receptionist, unpaid. She very rapidly found a house, because I was at that time living in accommodation, requisitioned by the army, and we became the focus of all the other subalterns who were there on their own and hadn't thought of what we'd decided to do. And eventually we had a party for all the subalterns. One sent word to the battalion. The colonel turned up. I was a little bit apprehensive, thinking I'd overstepped as usual, but he spoke to my wife, and after one drink away he went, and when I asked how long it was before I was going to be posted, he said, oh no, he just wanted to know what I was doing there and how. A week later, the colonel's wife appeared as a receptionist at one of the larger hotels, and eventually Dickie Annand was married, and the colonel decided to hold a cocktail party to meet Sylvia, who was coming down on a visit. The night, the big day came, Mary and I were at the party, and Dick walked in, but no bride. And the adjutant said, Richard, where's your wife? Oh, God, he said, she's... he'd forgotten she had a coat to take off. And he'd walked in, and she was standing in the cloakroom, not a very amused. But we had a very pleasant evening, and she didn't stay on the coast. And unfortunately, I don't know whether you remember, he was, his ears were very badly damaged, and he had very rapidly learnt lip reading, but one of the distressing, or not distressing, I shouldn't say that, one of the harder parts of our training were each subaltern in turn had to take command of the whole battalion and put them through manoeuvres. And to, on the sea front, if you can imagine a full battalion of 600 men assembled, and to have to give orders, and the wind blows on the east coast, to give orders to turn right and then have them retreating in the distance and having to work out how to call them back was not very easy. It taught you voice production.
This, due to the injuries he got winning the Victoria Cross?
Regrettably, they were so bad that the authorities decided it would have been grossly unfair to send him, because if he was drilling troops and they were marching away and they couldn't, he couldn't see, another subaltern was drilling and Richard couldn't see by his mouth what order he was giving, he was caught out and it was found that he couldn't hear. And so he was sent to the training battalion, much to his annoyance.
He must have been well thought of in the battalion.
Oh, terribly popular. One of the nicest people one could ever meet. I think, without exception, everyone in the battalion tried to cover up for him as long as they possibly could, until it was obvious that it would be unfair on him to let him continue in a battalion that was likely to go abroad shortly.
What other officers, obviously you had quite a number by now and you'd got used to them, what were they like? What are your recollections of the officers?
I must say, the regulars didn't care for the territorials. The regulars never did care for the territorials. And it was apparent in some of the tutes that we held. For instance, I'll tell you one story, not absolutely typical of all the officers, but some. Jasper Rudd had been with me in the 6th Battalion, and he'd gone as a reinforcement to the 2nd Battalion. And when the attack came upon the 2nd Battalion, Jasper was still serving with them. He took part in the withdrawal, and he and Oswald Pearson, the quartermaster, the doctor, the padre, and one other officer, Dennis, no, I can't remember, but only five of them came back with the remnants of the battalion. And he was a tiny little man. And the regulars didn't care for him, but I remember on one tut, he was asked a question and gave an answer, and the questioner, no names, no pack drill, the questioner said, "Oh, that's utter nonsense, Mr. Rudd." And Mr. Rudd drew himself up to his 5'1", and looked at this person and said, "Well, sir, it may be utter nonsense, but it worked perfectly well in France a few months ago. There was a very, very deathly hush, and people thought, I wonder how far away they're going to post Jasper.
As you trained with them over the months, did their attitude not change towards you as they saw how efficient you were?
Oh, as far as I was concerned, I had no trouble with any of them. Michael Hanmer and I used to occasionally disagree about odds and ends, but not in any unmilitary fashion, and I have no real cause to feel that. He obviously, like the other regulars, felt that we should know more than we did know. One can understand that. But I don't think Michael was very, very... He was my company commander for quite a while. He was the one that was given the job of telling me that my marriage leave was off three times. But possibly that came from the colonel and not from Michael. He was the one that said that my wife shouldn't be allowed to stay there, and I told him that he should ask her to move. He didn't. But apart from that, no, I I didn't bother with regular people. In fact, the only regular that I had trouble with was the RSM.
Who was that?
Lackenby, Charles Lackenby. And I think it was because, being a regular, he was used to subalterns coming direct from Sandhurst, not having had any experience. But I, at that time, was 25 years old, and I'd been in business for quite a number of years. I earned my own living for quite a number of years, and people have, without being offensive, limited knowledge and acumen of Lackenby didn't mean much to me.
Fellow officers in the company, who do you recall amongst those as being particularly...
Well, my friend Vane, that had gone to... France with me originally, had been called the emergency officer. He was in one of the other platoons in my company. He was a very, very industrious, hard-working officer, and I don't know, he had an idea that he wasn't fitting in with the battalion, and he actually volunteered to go into the Air Force. I didn't quite know why. It was because he was in another company and didn't get on. Sorry, we were posted to different companies. He didn't get on with his company commander, although he was emergency and not a territorial, and he applied to transfer the RAF. There weren't many other territorial officers, Rudd, who I'd mentioned before, myself. Oh, I'm sorry, I can't bring to mind.
You've mentioned one of your colonels who died, Mr. Way, was it?
Vier.
Vier. Who succeeded him?
He didn't die till after I left them. I'm sorry, he was still with them, but he had the breakdown afterwards.
You've mentioned how hard-working and strict disciplinarian he was.
Oh, the MO gave strict instructions to the adjutant to force the colonel to leave his office at 11 each night. And we used to hear the most extremely abusive language when the colonel stood his ground, the adjutant stood his ground and tried to persuade the colonel to go home and rest. He never seemed to leave the office before midnight. and he was terribly anxious that the 2nd Battalion, the Durham Light Infantry, was going to be the battalion training-wise. I once almost put my foot in it with the colonel. He gave him up reference to meet myself and the other two platoon commanders in front of our position and on a tour of his, one of his tours of inspection. And I read this instruction and noticed somebody had boobed, and if I'd followed it out, I'd have been 200 yards out into the sea. However, I interpreted it as being an error and met him there. And he was being very brusque and firing orders out all round and complaining about various places, not being exactly where we should be, and a matter of yards and so on. And I, he wasn't speaking to me at the time, and I turned to my friend Avain and said to him, if I'd carried out the orders I received, I'd have been 200 yards out to sea. And the colonel had heard this remark, turned round in a rage and said to me, what do you mean, what do you mean? Let me see those orders. And I produced the little memo, read it out to him, and he looked at it. Type it, sir. And I said, yes, sir. And my face must have conveyed something I didn't intend, because he said, a report at the order room to inspect my instructions at 5 o'clock. And I said, yes, sir. Having said that, I found him a charming person, and he was the sort of soldier that one finds so often in the British Army, a true professional. He would have gone a long way if it hadn't been for this driving himself.
Do you recall a second in command?
Oh. The second in command at that time was George Stobart, who had been with our battalion at one time in the 6th. And I think he'd missed a certain amount of training because he didn't seem quite as fit as the other officer chap. And I think myself that possibly he wasn't well enough to carry out the sort of rapid action-packed days that we were having. Anyhow, he went back to depot, I think I'm right in saying.
Where did he go?
I think he went back to a training battalion, but I'm not absolutely sure. But he was followed by Major Sebag Montefiore, and I can only think he'd been retired a while because he was very unfit. And it was probably his seniority in the regiment that had brought him back to this position. But it was realised at once that a frontline battalion wasn't really the place for him, and I think he opted for an extra regimental job. I don't know, but I think that was what happened. He was a very pleasant chap, but I think he was too old for the sort of situation we were in then. Oddly enough, I can't quite remember who followed him. I apologise, but I cannot.
The quality of the officers as a whole, across the whole battalion, was it high?
Oh yes, most of them were regulars, and they were all well trained. Michael Hanmer was, I think, quite a senior man at the time, and his second in command, who later became company commander, was Robert Allen, who at that time was an acting captain, and who I think was one of the nicest officers in the battalion. The rest of them, yes, they were all, the senior officers were all quite senior in years as well as in rank. Gibbs Kennett, one of them, for instance, was very, very keen. He drove his officers mercilessly. At least we got a little bit of humanity from Michael Hanmer, but Gibbs Kennett was absolutely dedicated, and I was very sorry for his officers. One of them, the Jasper Rudd I mentioned, opted out and applied to join the Royal Engineers. He was a surveyor.
What are your memories of the NCOs and men? Are you those outstanding?
Well, I think I've already mentioned Miles Etherington to you. The other sergeant majors, for instance, I can George Pinckney comes to mind at once. A contemporary of Etherington and of the same caliber, first class chap. And my own sergeant major was Shufflebottom, Samuel Shufflebottom. Sorry, the pause was for his Christian name. Samuel Shufflebottom, one can guess his origins, but a very, very good man, a very hard-working chap, and he drove the men from the point of view of discipline and the rest of it. He was all that one could wish for. Yes, right through the battalion, we had odd characters. We had one sergeant who, when he was speaking to an officer on the telephone, remained at attention, at the salute. But apart from odd characters like that, they were good, they were human, and they were all keen to make their platoon, company, or what would you, the best in the battalion. Yes, yes.
And this is right across the board, a wholesome change.
They didn't bring very many back. I think that with Jasper Rudd and Ozzy Pearson in Halifax, Huddersfield, rather, when we were joined them, I think that there was only 62, I think the figure was 62 men were actually present with the remnants. They were the people that were present when we first arrived. Others came back in the retreat down to Dunkirk that had been separated from the battalions. It was so difficult when people were withdrawing that units became intermingled, and what the regular soldiers did was to report to the unit that happened to be near them at the time and continue with them until contact could be made with their own battalions. They were all professional people and they behaved in that way.
Most of the men that would join in the ranks, where were they coming from?
We had a lot of reservists. A lot of reservists came back. We had, yes, we had conscripts as well. The militiamen, not a lot of militiamen, we had a few. We had, as I say, some territorials, but most of the people that came to us were, if not all ex-reservist Durhams, were ex-reservist Yorkshire and other regiments to fill in. But they tried to keep you in your own cap badge.
What was the influence of the men who had come back, who had action in France and come back, upon the who had no action at all?
They were looked up to in one respect, they were teased in another respect, and don't forget that the reservists had served with most of these people over the years. For instance, Jasper Rudd's Batman was had served 14 years, so that he knew not only UK, he knew India, he knew the world pretty well. And there were very, very, it's hard to describe it. It's a funny word to say. There were whole men, all-rounders. You could see that they'd been trained in the use of all arms, all infantry arms, of course, and their tactic, they could carry out these exercises we did. I shouldn't say standing on the heads, but second nature. They were good. And they kindly looked after the youngsters coming in. The conscripts that came in were taken in, and you generally found that they were adopted by the older soldiers. Very interesting the way they all became a family. Very, very interesting indeed. It surprised me, because having been in industry, I worked previous to the war on the Tyne, and we had 1,500 in our office alone. And we came from everywhere to the place. I actually was rather unusual in that I travelled 30 miles to the Tyne rather than live there. But most of the others came from either Newcastle or Sunderland, and they didn't gel. But with the battalion, the difference, the territorials, the reservists, the conscripts, all eventually welded. Because obviously, if your life depends on one another, this is how it must be. I was very, very fortunate in that I had a batman who was in my original territorial platoon, a lad called George Butler, been spoiled by his mother, but was keen to learn, was smart in his ways, was clean in his nature, and carried out my orders, even if it meant being, shall we say, slightly dishonest. So, yes, it was a good battalion, a happy battalion, and one I was very, very upset to leave.
Where did you go to after Bridlington?
We moved to, it was a concentration at that stage. We moved to a village called Wintringham, which is near York, but the other companies were in places like Rillington and the various places around, with headquarters down at Moulton. Excuse me. At that time we were doing brigade exercises and carrying out enormous marches. I remember one where we left Wintringham and we marched, we hit the coast at Saltburn, which was a matter of 56 miles, I think it was. What's interesting about it was we did it in just over 24 hours. And I felt my chaps had shown that they were ready for service.
What was the marching pace?
120. And March past 140. Usual breaks 10 minutes in the hour. And the men were so well trained. that they could keep this up. And if any of them were slacking, and I, on the odd march back, had to take a rifle from one of the younger boys, they tended to jeer at him, and they didn't like to do it twice.